The McNeil and Parkin Show. Afternoons on the Score.
Takes his time. Here's the pitch.
He got it, Gary Templeton. The 3,000th strikeout of his career. Gary Templeton goes down swinging. And Ferguson Jenkins being congratulated. Throws the baseball into the dugout. All of his teammates coming out to shake his hand. The photographers are out there. A historic moment for Chicago Cubs baseball. A standing ovation. It all started 17 years ago when he struck out Dick Groat in 1965. Listen to the crowd.
It's a visitor, but a lot of them came to see it.
The McNeil and Parkin Show on 670 The Score.
That call from that legendary broadcaster of that legendary moment brought a smile to the face of our next guest. Hall of Famer, three-time All-Star, Cy Young winner, over 3,000 strikeouts. He led his league in complete games four times. He won 20-plus games seven times. Fergie Jenkins in studio with Mac and Parkins on The Score. Hey, Fergie.
Hey, guys. How we doing?
Good to have you. Always great to talk baseball with you. Collective sigh of relief a little bit yesterday on the north side. That's how you ring in a home schedule, isn't it, Fergie?
Definitely. Opening day, I think you got to tell yourself and the team, this is your home ballpark. Now you got to punish somebody. And they went out and scored some runs, and that's what it's all about.
Did you have fun yesterday?
Oh, definitely. Being on the field with four other Hall of Famers, and the new inductee, Lee Smith. I mean, he has taken it all in. I think he's really understanding what the Hall of Fame is really all about.
Yeah, I was just going to add, I mean, you saw him at the very beginning, right?
In 82, when he came up in 80, the end of 81 season. And I seen him learn how to be a bullpen pitcher and how to close games off. And we used to sit out in the outfield and just talk about the game of baseball. And then I showed him a few grips.
Really?
He had an outstanding curveball, but he didn't throw it much, but he had a great slider.
He got great to slider. Throw out the ceremonial pitch yesterday.
Yes, Lee. He did.
And it's the first time I've ever seen him, Fergie, where he didn't look like he was in pain. Didn't he always have that pained expression on his face?
I mean, as big as he is, he's letting it go. Let me tell you, when you're 240 pounds, 6'6", let me tell you, you're letting it go. But, I mean, he's gained a lot of weight, but other than that, he wouldn't go to the rubber. I wanted him to go back to the rubber.
Yeah. Throw,
but he didn't. He threw it from the grass.
Come on. That's why he gets 60 feet, 6 inches.
He gets a handicap for the weight.
Yeah, that's
he's
it, probably.
He's carrying a few extra pants. Oh, but, you're in 42 waisted pants?
Yeah.
All right, come on up to the grass.
That's a little disappointing for a Hall of Famer. Toe the rubber one more time.
Yeah, that would have been nice. Yeah.
So what did you teach him specifically? What did you take credit
for? We used to throw in the outfield. We work on his grip with a slider. He didn't have much of a breaking pitch. And I think over the course of about a month or so, spring training and into the season, he
wow.
developed a really, really good slider. And as I said, he had a good curveball, but Jim Frey didn't want him to throw it. He had had three pitches, fastball, curveball, slider. But he ended up with two, fastball, slider. And he got a lot of saves, 470s, 490, something like that, saves.
Fergie Jenkins is in studio with us promoting his new book, The 1969 Cubs, Long Remembered, Never Forgotten. And if you want this Fergie Jenkins t-shirt, which I'm putting up right now at Brian Gertsch's video stream at watch670thescore.com on our Facebook page, it's got all of his accolades on the back, National Baseball Hall of Fame, 1981.
That one in your hands will not fit on Lee Smith based on Fergie's description.
No, not really.
But you can send an email to autograph1@gmail.com. That's autograph1@gmail.com if you want information on the shirts. Man, you're tough on Lee Smith, huh?
Well, the biggest thing is learning how to be a Hall of Famer. You know, his new name is No Show Lee, because he used to be very late showing up. I said, Lee, you are now in the Hall of Fame. Be nice to be prompt.
He's going to be late to his own speech.
Punctuality is an asset.
Oh,
right?
Totally, totally. And you got to tell people that you're willing to understand what the Hall of Fame is all about. And he does. I mean, he's really enjoyed it over the last 2.5-3 months. See, that I think the announcement was in December. So he's had a chance all through spring training and now the starting of the season. And he doesn't get inducted until July to understand what the Hall of Fame is all about and to understand that you are now a different individual. You are part of a different party in the game of baseball, being a Hall of Famer.
What changes?
Theoretically, money, appearances.
Appearances, sure.
And you got to carry yourself a different way. I mean, whenever I do appearance, I wear a sport coat. I mean, there's no more, hey, floppy jeans, and I wear cowboy boots all the time still. But the thing is, that I just think that the dress is very important, being punctual and understanding that you're in a different class now, and you can write HOF behind your name. Really important.
Mm-hmm. What will we learn about the 69 Cubs in this new offering you wrote?
Well, the biggest thing is I'm trying to recap what the season was all about, starting in spring training and then the season. And believe me, the heat didn't bother us. We played day games well before that. So we got plenty of hits. We just didn't score runs. We might have led the league in double plays at the end of the season, those last 3.5-4 weeks.
But Ernie and Sano got really cold in September, if I remember correctly.
Becker and Kessinger. Hickman was our best clutch hitter with Billy Williams, but we just didn't score the runs that we should have. We had men on base, but we just didn't get the key base hit.
Did Leo use the bench enough?
No. We had a couple of guys. We had Nate Oliver, Gene Oliver, Willie Smith. There were some guys that were sitting there waiting, Popovich.
Mm-hmm.
But Leo played the guys that he theoretically thought were going to bring us home the last maybe 20 games.
What was your motivation for wanting to write the book?
It's a 50th year anniversary. George Castle got a hold of me about 8 months ago and said, Ferg, 50 years is coming up. This was 2018. And I said, I'd like to put something together and just let the Chicago fans know what that year was all about to the players that are still alive, because we've lost 16 of those players off that 25-man roster. And just to get an insight of what the team and the management, the Leo, and the players that were on the field, what they went through to try to win that that division, but it just didn't happen.
It's staggering how much love a team that didn't get to the postseason has received for 50 years now, isn't it? I mean, aren't you just amazed at how recognized you are around North America?
Well, the biggest thing is we had 5 Hall of Famers, including Leo, myself, Billy, Ernie, and Ron Santo, all in one ball club. And to really play as well as we did and then all of a sudden not fall flat, but just didn't do the fundamental things we should have done. The Mets just played a little better.
Does it still bother you?
No, not really. We played as hard as we could to get there. I look back at some of the games I pitched, maybe a pitch here, a sequence of maybe pitching to different hitters a certain way might have turned something around, but that's water under the bridge now.
What's the thing that fans ask you about the most from the 69 Cubs?
Why didn't you win?
Fair question.
The biggest thing is, people cried. I cried too. She said, "You're not the only one. I was there. I cried when we didn't win."
I'm refreshing myself this morning, and I'm looking at your numbers on baseballreference.com, and I see five seasons where he eclipsed 300 innings pitched, and of the five, led the league only one time. That's kind of crazy. I mean, 4-man rotations, but what has happened where pitchers just, is it the human growth phenomenon? Too much terror on the rotis laughing at me as I'm trying to ask
the question. I think it's agents. Agents and the ball club doesn't want to overwork their players. 200 inning maximum is kind of the thing that they look
That's
at
That's an
now.
Accomplishment now.
One year, I almost had 200 innings at the All-Star break. But, that's just something that the game has changed in that respect. There's 7 or 8 guys in the bullpen, and there's always 2 guys are the called-upon individuals. They're the manager looks at them as the strategy. Could be a left-hander, could be a right-hander. Then you've got holders, you've got the setup, and then the closer. And there's 5 starters. There's 13 pitchers on the team now.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a little different. When I broke in, there was only 9. To make the ball club, you better have a good spring training. Or Gene Mlock, when I was with the Phillies, you weren't going to make that ball club.
In terms of, I once made the argument that all of the best athletes are playing today, or basically, right? Because just evolution, sports science, massage therapists, nutritionists. And someone came back and said, "Oh yeah, how come no one can throw a complete game anymore?" I was like, "Oh, checkmate." Like, I didn't really have an answer for it. So do you think that the athletes have gotten worse? That doesn't make much sense to me intellectually that they'd be worse today.
They haven't gotten worse. I just think it's the preparation a lot of times. I ran all the time. I had stamina. I think the lower half of my body was always pretty strong, the core. And to get to the 7th and 8th inning, I didn't walk a lot of people. maybe one or two batters or less, and maybe four or five hits. So there wasn't a lot of men on base. I wasn't pitching out of the stretch a lot, and my pitch count was low. Maybe had, when I got to the seventh inning, 85 to 90 pitches. And now I had that opportunity to maybe to get to the ninth. If Kessinger got on, I had to bunt him over. Or if Randy Hunley got on, I had to bunt him over. It all depends on how what the lineup was all about. Or if I had a chance to go up there and swing for myself, I could do that too, because I wasn't a bad hitter.
You were a terrific hitter. No. I just in an era when a few guys were willing to swing the bat and not just stand there like a statue. Well, Bill Hands was a bit of a statue, but you worked at it.
Oh, yeah. I took a lot of batting practice. Both Kenny Holzman and even in 70, Milt Pappas and I used to have a contest all the time hitting home runs in batting practice. But the thing was to put the ball in play. I was very fortunate enough. I wasn't afraid to hit against guys like Drysdale or Gibson or Seaver or whoever the other pitcher was. I was standing in there. I wasn't just going to take a pitch. If they laid a fastball in there, I was trying to whack it as far as I could.
So who was the best hitter among the pitchers?
In my era?
Yeah. Fergie was among them.
Well, I was right there. Kenny Holzman and I, we got a lot of hits. One year, I had well over 20-some hits and 20-some RBIs. Yeah.
How do you feel about the DH going away in the National League, which is where everybody's wanting it to go?
Well, yeah, they propose it every year, but the National League turns it down. Keep it in the American League.
You don't think it should be in the National League?
No, I think if the guys work at
it. You think it's fun watching Kyle Hendricks stand there and look scared for three pitches?
Well, he's got something to work on. You know, when Lester came here, he didn't get a hit until he'd been at bat almost, the season was almost
that's
over.
That's true.
Right.
Now he's turned into a much better hitter. So I think you have to work at it. I mean, there's so many different things. Base running, being able to bunt, and being able to put the ball in play. And I think, you know, when you spend 7-8 years in the American League like Lester did, you don't go to the plate. So you've got to work at it.
Then he gets hurt running the bases, though.
That hamstring. I think he just pulled it slightly. So he might not miss a rotation start.
Joe said today it'll be a start, maybe two. We're talking to Fergie Jenkins in studio. You can get his T-shirt by sending an email to autograph1@gmail.com. His book is available on Amazon, The 1969 Cubs, Long Remembered, Never Forgotten. I wanted to talk to you about Lester. He's kind of a throwback. It's 11 consecutive years starting 31 or more games, which you started that number of games 11 times. So the same thing between you and Lester. And he's trying to be more of a leader. Theo asked him to be more of a leader. Can you be a leader of a 25-man club when you're only playing once every 5 days?
Sure. They depend on you to go out there and have a top performance. You can change the losing series. You can keep the winning series going. And I think the number one thing is to understand the ball club will play hard for you if you pitch hard. And that's the number one thing that he's capable of doing, keeping your ball club in the game, giving up less runs, throwing strikes, keeping your players on their toes, and by far – seeing they play hard for you, you play hard.
What were your expectations of this pitching staff? We're 10 games in, 4-6 now, but have lost three straight series. What did you think of this staff when they broke camp?
Well, they had a great spring. You know, I think the number one factor that to me, Darvish hadn't really pitched enough. He still didn't have the control. Hendricks has the control. So does the left-hander we got from the White Sox.
Quintana.
Yeah. I like him, but he's got to throw more breaking pitches. I think the fastball he's got has less movement than what he thinks with the catcher. I think he has a better breaking ball, better slider. I just think they've got – and the young fellow they got from the Texas Rangers.
Mm-hmm, Hamels.
Hamels. I think that they've got the right people.
The young fellow. He's 35.
Well, hey, when I was 35, I considered myself young.
Sure.
So I said, I'm going to play it on 40, which I did. But the thing is that I think that they've got the pitching staff that can still win. They just got to keep putting the numbers up. You got to pitch a lot of innings. And by far, you got to win a series. You just can't keep losing series one after the other, one after the other. But I think they're capable.
What about the bullpen?
They got to work at the bullpen. That's a little different story right now. Morrow, I'm not sure when he's coming back. But he was a cog with the Dodgers, and I thought he was excellent with the Cubs that first year. But now he just can't seem to get back.
We'll keep telling stories and get analysis. Fergie is on top of his game today with this team and, of course, stories from yesteryear. His book, The 1969 Cubs, Long Remembered, Never Forgotten, available Amazon.com. Fergie Jenkins in studio with us. McNeil and Park is on the score.
On this day, I'm not only being inducted alone. I'm being inducted on July 21st, 1991, with my father, Fergie Jenkins Sr., Hershey.
It is with the deepest humility and the warmest regards for the sport I accept this prestigious award, acknowledgement and the recognition from the Baseball Writers of America and the National Baseball Hall of Fame. I will cherish it forever. Thank you very much.
A pro's pro and a Hall of Famer in the 1991 class, Fergie Jenkins in studio. McNeil and Park is on the score. This hour brought to you by Vasectomy Clinics of Chicago, Hub Arkish at 4 o'clock. If you want a Fergie Jenkins t-shirt, you can send an email to autograph and then the number one, the word autograph, number one, at gmail.com. And his book, The 1969 Cubs, Long Remembered, Never Forgotten, available now on amazon.com.
Fergie far too modest about his offensive prowess during his career. In 71, he hit .243, Parkins, with an OBP of .282, six homers, drove in 20 runs, and oh yeah, he won the Cy Young as well, another season with 20 wins, six consecutive 20-win seasons.
Do you enjoy people reading your numbers to you?
You have to, don't you?
It'd be kind of
cool.
Well,
I get reminded of sometimes. But, you know, it's nice to know that, hey, I was able to accomplish that. But, you know, a lot of times you forget the numbers. But I always remember six 20-game seasons because the Cubs, the teammates I had, gave me that opportunity to win ballgames. And Leo left me in ballgames, 2-1, 3-2, to get that opportunity to possibly win a game, maybe in the eighth or ninth inning.
In 68, and you won 20 games in 68, that's one of the six straight, you also lost 5 1-0 games and were in a no decision in another 1-0 Cubs loss.
Right.
That's crazy. No wonder they lowered the mound the following year in 69. You guys were picking on those poor wimps like Mays and Aaron and Yastrzemski. You were too rough on those guys, man.
Well, there's a lot of guys that we got out easy. But maybe the easiest, Cepeda might have been my easiest out.
Orlando Cepeda, really?
Yeah. I was just fortunate enough. He just didn't pick up the spin on my slider, which was I was pretty happy.
Who was a hack who did pick you up? A guy who wasn't a really good ball player but had good success against Ferguson Arthur Jenkins.
Don Money.
Don Money, the third baseman.
With Milwaukee, you know. But, I mean, and he played with the Phillies, too. But, I mean, he just picked the ball up. There were a few guys that could pick it up. I mean, not saying that guys were just hacks, but if you throw them enough sliders, they understand where it's going.
And who's the toughest battle?
Probably Roberto Clemente. You know, Pete Rose is going to get his hits. Some hitters you can't stop. Rod Carew can't stop. But Clemente was dangerous all the time. He hit the ball up the middle. If you made a bad pitch over the plate or outside, he reached out and tapped it up the middle. And you could hear it go by you. Thank you. Thank God it didn't hit me.
Man, those are some incredible names. Was there ever someone who you faced, they got in the box against you, and you're just like, man, I can't believe I'm pitching to this guy. Was there a welcome to the big leagues, I can't believe I'm in the same field with this guy moment?
Well, the first time I faced Willie Mays out in San Francisco on a road trip, I'm trying to think of the lineup. McCovey, I think, hit third, Mays fourth, and probably Bobby Bonds fifth or sixth, and they had a good hitting lineup.
That's Willie, a good order.
Yeah, that'll work.
I just think that Felipe Lou was in that lineup too, and I just think that the first time you face Willie Mays, you know, as a kid you said, "Man, if I could ever get to the big leagues, I'd love to face him." And here he is, digging in at the plate.
I got bad Willie Mays, and it was still good Willie Mays. I mean, still with the Giants. That last year with the Mets was a disaster. But even at the end, in the late 60s, when he was an old player, he still was a fantastic player.
Yeah,
defensively, too.
He could still catch the ball, throw, and he still had good speed. But he could put the ball in play. I mean, he could – I think the biggest thing is the bat speed hadn't changed a whole lot, and he still attacked the ball.
Was he your favorite player as a kid?
There was two. Mickey Mantle was one, Hank Aaron probably second, and Mays three. But I had a chance to face Aaron and Mays a lot, only Mickey Mantle in all-star competition.
Oh, wow. What was that like?
Interesting.
Yeah.
Announce his name, you go, all right, Mickey Mantle, okay.
Did you go out with him by any chance? That might have been a fun
night.
Yeah,
right.
We have a texter wanting to know where your Canadian accent is today.
I've lost it. I signed when I was 18 years old. I came over here in 1962. I think my accent's gone.
Plus, Chatham, Ontario is just on the other side of Detroit.
Yeah, 50, right? that's, 60 that's, miles away. You're right.
That's basically Detroit.
Almost. Well, yeah. my dad was born in Windsor, Okay. And from Windsor to Chatham, it's about 50 miles. But I don't say about or out anymore. You know,
did you play hockey when you were a kid?
Yes, I did.
You had to, right? Oh, it's definitely. Law in Canada.
Yeah, I started skating when I was 4 years old. Yeah.
And you played with the Globetrotters.
Yeah, I played with them 3 seasons.
Man. Yeah. So do you think you were the guy that was such a good athlete that you could have gone pro in a sport other than baseball?
Well, my first sport was hockey, and that's what I wanted, to be an NHL hockey player, but it just didn't work out. And the scout that signed me, Gene DeJura, at the age of 15, said that, you know, I seen you play at first, and I watched you warm up. I said, I think you got a definite opportunity. If you want to be a pro player, pitching might be the way to go. And he was right.
He was pretty good advice.
Yes, he was. Yeah, man, I worked at it. I threw every Tuesday and Thursday, he'd pick me up, and I'd throw in a local gymnasium. And I got better with my control. I got better throwing the ball, movement. And I signed in 62 with the Phillies, and I had an opportunity to turn pro.
What's the craziest thing that being a member of the Harlem Globetrotters, like, what's the craziest door that opened for you?
Meadowlark, Curly, geez, Bobby Joe Mason, so many of these guys, Showboat Hall, Geese Osby, just being on the same bus with them and saying to myself, I played a certain sport, but now I'm entertaining with another sport. And these guys were great basketball players and great entertainers, and they welcomed me into their world. And I look back at, I was grateful for it. And they, every night, they played to win. We never lost to the Generals. We never lost.
Hard group to fit in with?
No. Curly Neal welcomed me. He was the first one to welcome me. He was a big baseball fan. He loved baseball. And then Meadowlark and Leon Hilliard, a bunch of the guys, they just kind of welcomed me in, which was really nice for that situation. It made it a lot easier for me to play.
Fergie, yesterday at Wrigley Field, you get a chance to get reacquainted with some ex-teammates and some Cubs legends. One who has not been back for some time is Sammy Sosa. Parkins, you know, was 12 when Sosa was doing his thing years ago.
It was 12 in 1998,
yeah,
summer 98.
Sammy was a reason to go to the ballpark, and the only reason for a few years. I wish some things were different, because that number 21 should be flying somewhere in Wrigley Field. Don't you agree?
Definitely. I met Sammy when he was 17 years old in the Texas organization. And when he came up from Tulsa and I was a coach at Oklahoma City, I could see he had the potential to be there.
Fergie Jenkins in studio in 10 minutes. Great storyteller, legendary career. Was at Cubs opening day yesterday. We'll bring him in studio in 10 minutes. People want to weigh in. I think we've gone too far in technology. I think for the history of basketball, that ball gets hit off the Tech player by the millisecond, by the Zapruder film, one frame. It'd be Tech ball. They review it for a couple minutes last night. It goes to Virginia. It just seems like an unintended consequence of replay to me. And we've got it in baseball with right over a bag on a slide. We're going to have it in football with pass interference. And people say, hey, it's right. It was off Tech.
Okay. Yes, it was. You've agreed. It was off Tech.
It was off Tech. And if it's that black and white, fine. I can't argue against it. I would say that there are consequences of being that black and white, whether it's to the enjoyment of the sport, the intention of the rule, the spirit of the rule, the flow of the game, extra timeouts, rest, all of that stuff, that I actually am willing for some imperfection in order to have flow of the game.
You have to be, because the enjoyment of the game has changed since replay became a part of it, and it's been a part of it now in pro sports for 30 years with the NFL, 30-plus years.
It's crazy.
Yeah. I mean, that Bears-Packers game, that Mikowski over-the-line game,
yeah,
which I think was the first or second year of replay, that was a replay game, and they got it wrong looking at the replay.
That's the thing.
Yeah, ask Chico that next time.
If you told me that they got it right 100% of the time, it'd be a different conversation. That's clearly not the case.
Yeah.
Earl in Cicero says, I've never watched basketball. What's up, Earl?
Hey, Parkins, come on. You watch the basketball game, the last 2 minutes takes an hour. There is no flow in the last 2 minutes. There's timeouts, there's fouls. That's part of the game. I'd rather have them get it right. And I'm all for it, and I can't wait till they put the electronic strike zone in baseball. I'm getting sick and tired of these umps. One guy's got one strike zone, the other's got another. That's not right.
I'm for automated strike zone in baseball, because it'll be uniform. Once they get that technology right, it'll be the same for everybody every game. I'm fine with that.
Well, basketball, though, I like this. I like the getting it right, especially a big game like
that. You've already been right, Earl. I think you feel like I do. You've already been waiting. You know, you're going to wait through the last 2 minutes anyway. You might as well get the damn calls right.
You got it, the Big Mac. You got it.
Thanks, Earl.
Thanks, Earl.
Earl.
You know a sport that's great with replay? Tennis. You ever watch the tennis match?
No, not since they went to replay.
It's amazing. They just have the whole court digitized.
Mm-hmm.
They can do it instantaneously.
Yeah.
And you can't complain about it. Was the ball in or out?
You can. It's just who do you complain to?
Man. Was it on the line? Was it not on the line?
Mm-hmm.
It's unbelievable. Let's go to Tony in Rockford. Tony, you're on the score.
Hey, Danny Mac. You know, Parkins, your original argument was you said you don't want calls that can't be determined by the naked eye. There have been so many calls that have not been determined by the naked eye to be wrong. The Saints playoff game, the Cardinals in the 85 World Series when Don Dinkinger missed by a foot, a step and a half. You're going to get naked eye calls missed. You might as well get them right.
Yeah, but see, okay, so use the Dinkinger example. That is one where an egregious wrong would be righted quickly with replay, safe
but
or
it was
out.
Missed. But you said it shouldn't. A call shouldn't be determined by something that wasn't originally caught by the naked eye.
I'm saying no. That can't be called with the naked eye. Like plenty of people could have made that call correct that Don Dinkinger made incorrect last night. Nobody watching in real time would call that ball off tech. You need to be able to slow it down.
Nobody. I'm not so sure about nobody. Somebody might have seen it graze. It did. It was just a graze. It was an ever so slight possession, but
maybe
that's what it was.
Tony, I appreciate the
call.
Thank
you, Tony.
Fergie Jenkins, Mac, first baseball pitcher you ever watched. So you were a Billy Williams kid.
We are in the presence of greatness, man. There is a Hall of Famer just feet away from us.
A Cy Young winner, over 3,000 strikeouts. He led his league in complete games four separate times. Fergie Jenkins in studio with Mac and Parkins next on the score.
It's ridiculous. It is 100% patently false. So it's either he made that crap up, or what he would probably do as a writer is say, oh, this is my sources problem. They told me something. I talked to Mark last week, and I said, Mark, did you tell somebody about the conversation? He goes, that's ridiculous. And I said, because that's not what happened. And he told, yeah, of course that's not what happened. We had a great conversation, like we always do. So that's just one point, that article, amongst a number of highly questionable things. Not to mention unnamed sources. I mean, put your name onto something.
Aaron Rodgers with a strong response on ESPN Madison, Wilde and Tausch, I believe the name of the radio show. He was not holding back after the Bleacher Report piece on him and Mike McCarthy.
I loved it. It was it's the number one story in pro football this week, and all it is gossip. It's really, you know, it'll all be forgotten when the ball goes in the air in September, but it's damn fun from our perspective here in Chicago, being as close as we are, and obviously a lot of people interested in the Packers, especially when it comes to Packers drama and Packers free fall. And Rodgers says in that bite near the end of it, put your name on it. Some guys did, and then he called them irrelevant.
Yeah, he went.
I love that.
He went after Greg Jennings. He went after Jermichael Finley. On Jennings, who's trying to turn into and have like a media career, he goes, he's only on the shows when he's talking about me. He's basically like, get some new material, man. Like, he went pretty hard on these guys. And he went hard on Ty Dunn, the writer,
who is a really
good reporter. But here's some more from the ESPN Milwaukee and Madison radio show from Aaron Rodgers.
You know, the thing is about this article, it's – you know, it's not a mystery. This was a smear attack by, you know, a writer looking to advance his career, talking with mostly irrelevant, bitter players who all have an agenda, whether they're advancing their own careers or just trying to stir old stuff up. The crazy thing is there's super slanted opinions in that piece stated as fact. And then there's quote-unquote facts, which are just outright lies. If I really dislike Mike that much, why would I re-sign? This idea that I had this like grudge against him for years is absolutely ridiculous. It's just not true. I mean, where was that grudge in 10 when we won the Super Bowl? Where was that grudge when we won 19 games in a row? Because I will tell you this about Mike, and if you look at the comments I've made about him over the years, I love Mike McCarthy. Mike has been a huge part of my success and my career, and I've had some amazing moments on and off the field with Mike. We have had issues, no doubt about it. Any long relationship has issues. But the way that we dealt with those issues, Mike and I, was face-to-face.
I thought last week when we read the reports, I think it was Thursday, Rodgers needed to respond to this quickly. He did, and I think he exonerated himself. I think he makes McCarthy look a lot more competent than we were led to believe a few days ago after reading that story. And I think that's a checkmate to the entire conversation right there.
I don't at all. I think that he did a great job in the interview, but in terms of a checkmate to the conversation, there's always been stuff about Rodgers' leadership, and he won whatever power struggle there was, right? Mike McCarthy said, I'm a highly successful football coach. Well, they fired you. So the offense didn't perform at a high level when Rodgers was out. So Rodgers won that battle, and so now it's on him. Are you going to embrace Matt LaFleur? He said at a different point in that interview that he called Mark Murphy and was like, hey, did you tell anyone?
Say that I was being a bad actor here? And Murphy said, no, I didn't say that. It's a complete fabrication.
So I do think that this is the type of story that now at least some people are on the record besmirching the great Aaron Rodgers, that if he stumbles, people will pile on. And if he succeeds and overcomes it, more people will pile on McCarthy and say that he was the problem that was holding them back.
Well, yeah, sure. Yes, the McCarthy bashers are a very vocal group, I've noticed. I work with one.
I resemble that remark.
Rodgers pointed out some things that are realities that often escape us. People in very close relationships have issues.
Yep.
There are going to be bumps along the way. They work together for a long time, and quarterback and head coach in pro football is a very tenuous relationship. Brady and Belichick have been that way. There are probably blips in every coach-quarterback relationship. If that thing's going to exceed a couple of years, they're not always going to see eye to eye, and they're going to have very strong convictions and not agree with each other. If it went too far and Green Rodgers is pulling back now saying no, he had a lot of respect. Where was all this talk when we were winning 19 in a row? Where's all this talk when we won the Super Bowl in 2010? And he's right. There wasn't any of it because things were going well.
Right. But I just think that he's such a big star, and Matt LaFleur is a first-time head coach of such a big franchise in terms of following and attention and fanfare. This is a guy who's been entrusted with whatever prime Aaron Rodgers has left, whether it's one more season or five more seasons, it's got to be on the success or failure of the LaFleur-Rodgers relationship. So I think this is the type of story that lingers. He did a great job. Don't get me wrong. He was strong. He was composed. He shifted the blame back to the journalist and disgruntled employees.
And his ex-teammates who chose to go on the record. He calls them irrelevant and bitter, and he's probably right.
Absolutely. I thought he did as good of a job as he could have done. I think he did that good of a job.
Mm-hmm.
I just think that it's kind of like the Patrick Mooney and Sahad of Sharma athletic story. Like it or not?
No, because everybody is still here. The McCarthy being gone is, you know, most of that story was about their fractured relationship.
I mean, but half of it was about...
Some of it was about LaFleur.
And some of it was just about Rodgers. Undercutting players, not letting Greg Jennings, not being happy that Greg Jennings said hi to Brett Favre, changing his coach's play calls, saying that they were dumb play calls. Plenty of it was just about Aaron Rodgers.
Yeah.
So I think that part of it will stick. And then the first time that there's something between LaFleur and Rodgers, there will be the conversation on Undisputed or First Take or whatever. Is Aaron Rodgers a coach killer?
Yeah, probably. You know, he's kind of made his own bed with that.
And so I just think that it's part of the narrative. I think it's part of the narrative for him going forward, rightly or wrongly. I just think that when you're that big of a star, he's the LeBron James of the NFL. He's that guy that people have.
Nah, I would go with Brady in that regard.
But Brady's I just feel like Brady's closer to Jordan, like in terms of who's anti-Brady. Rodgers is a little bit more polarizing in that way. Like, some people still have the issue with LeBron. So, people will debate him is, I guess, my only point. Yeah. And so I think that the story will stick to him. Hub has always been connected to Green Bay. Fascinated to see where he comes out on the journalism around it and where they go from here. And also, he was at the Zach Miller press conference today for the Ed Block Courage Award.
Yes.
Dude is not saying that he's going to retire yet. He's not giving up the dream.
Well, then he's the only one who doesn't know that he's retired.
Yeah, and I get it. There's a monetary thing, and the Bears helped him out last year. But
yes, they did.
I'm curious how that conversation went. Hub was there, so we'll bring Hub on next on The Score.